on the bottom of page 93. When the child of morning, rosy-fingered dawn, appeared, I want to point that out to you for a quick second. That's the first epithet we're going to see. Remember, we've defined the word epithet several times, a short describing phrase. Language is formal or grand. We don't just say, the sun rose. We say, when the child of morning, rosy-fingered dawn, appeared, we admired the island and wandered all over it, while the nymphs, Zeus's daughters, roused the wild goats that we might get some meat for our dinner. On this we fetched our spears and bows and arrows from the ships, and dividing ourselves into three bands, began to shoot the goats. Heaven sent us excellent sport. I had 12 ships with me, and each ship got 9 goats, while my own ship had 10. Thus, through the livelong day to the going down of the sun, we ate and drank our fill, and we had an abundance of wine left, for each one of us had taken many jars full when we sacked the city of the Sicones. Remember, they robbed the people, so they have a lot of wine left over. This had not yet run out. While we were feasting, we kept turning our eyes toward the land of the Cyclops, which was close by, and saw the smoke of their stubble fires. We could almost fancy we heard their voices and the bleating of their sheep and goats. But when the sun went down and it came on dark, we camped down upon the beach, and the next morning I called a council. Odysseus continues, "Stay here, my brave fellows," said I, "all the rest of you, while I go with my ship and exploit these people myself. I want to see if they are uncivilized savages or a hospitable and human race." I went on board, bidding my men to do so also, and loose the hawsers. So they took their places and smote the gray sea with their oars. When they got to the land, which was not far, there, on the face of a cliff near the sea, we saw a great cave overhung with laurels. It was a station for a great many sheep and goats. And outside there was a large yard with a high wall around it, made of stones built into the ground and of trees, both pine and oak. This was the abode of a huge monster who was then away from home shepherding his flocks. He would have nothing to do with other people, but led the life of an outlaw. He was a horrid creature, not like a human being at all, but resembling rather some crag that stands out boldly against the sky on the top of a high mountain. I told my men to draw the ship ashore and stay where they were, all but the 12 best among them who were going to go along with myself. I want you to be able to keep that number in your mind, Odysseus plus 12 soldiers. I also took a goat skin of sweet black wine, which had been given me by Maron, son of Euanthes, who was priest of Apollo, the patron god of Ismarus, and lived within the wooded precincts of the temple. When we were sacking the city, we respected him and spared his life, as also his wife and child. So he made me some presents of great value, 7 talents of fine gold and a bowl of silver, with 12 jars of sweet wine unblended and of the most exquisite flavor. Not a man nor maid in the house knew about it, but only himself, his wife, and one housekeeper. When he drank it, he mixed 20 parts of water to 1 of wine, and yet the fragrance from the mixing bowl was so exquisite that it was impossible to refrain from drinking. I filled a large skin with this wine and took a wallet full of provisions with me, for my mind warned me that I might have to deal with some savage who would be of great strength and would respect neither right nor law. Okay, so he tells a little by story here, but it's actually really important about this wine. Back when they had landed at Ismarus and they killed everyone, there was one dude, one priest, who he said, "All right, I won't kill you, and I won't kill your wife, and I won't kill your kid." And this priest said, "Oh, thank you, how can I repay you? I'll give you some presents." So he gives him some gold, and most importantly, he gives him this unblended wine. Basically, that means, think about science, it's undiluted. Think about, I know a good comparison. You know those little Mio, those little like drops that you put in a water bottle? That's what the unblended wine is like. So normally when you drink it, you would have 20 parts water. So imagine you've got this huge punch bowl, okay? You would have 20 cupfuls of water and 1 cupful of Mio, and it's still awesome wine. But what he has is the super concentrated, unblended, super potent, right? This is wine we're talking about. It's some strong stuff. And that's what he has with him. We soon reached his cave, but he was out shepherding. So we went inside and took stock of all that we could see. This is the top of 95. Imagine this for a second. Remember when I was talking about hospitality, I said imagine that you knock on Mrs. Mitchell's door and Mrs. Mitchell lets you in and shows you hospitality. If I wasn't home, would you just walk right in and help yourself to my apple juice and cookies?
Maybe.
Would it be a great idea? Are you seeing some little warning bells in your heads right now, little light bulbs going off? His cheese racks were loaded with cheeses, and he had more lambs and kids than his pens could hold. They were kept in separate flocks. First there were the hoggets, then the oldest of the younger lambs, and lastly the very young ones, all kept apart for one another. As for his dairy, all the vessels, bowls, and milk pails into which he milked were swimming with whey. When they saw all this, my men begged me to let them first steal some cheese and make off with them to the ship. They would then return, drive down the lambs and kids, and put them on board and sail away with them. It would have indeed been better if we had done so, but I would not listen to them. This is like a reverse of the Sacones, right? This time he says, the men say, Odysseus, please, let's just steal some of this awesome cheese and grab some goats and get going before we get in trouble. And he says, but I would not listen to them. I wanted to see the owner of this cave himself in the hope that he might give me a present. He's expecting hospitality. When, however, we saw him, my poor men found him ill to deal with. Kind of an understatement here, you'll see in a moment. We lit a fire, offered some of the cheeses in sacrifice, ate others of them, and then sat waiting till the Cyclops should come in with his sheep. When he came, he brought in with him a huge load of dry firewood to light the fire for his supper. And this he flung with such a noise onto the floor of his cave that we hid ourselves for fear at the far end of the cavern. Meanwhile, he drove all the ewes inside, as well as the she-goats that he was going to milk, leaving the males, both rams and he-goats, outside in the yards. Then he rolled a huge stone to the mouth of the cave. It was so huge that 22 strong four-wheeled wagons would not be enough to draw it from its place against the doorway. When he had done so, he sat down and milked his ewes and goats, all in due course, and then let each of them have her own young. He curdled half the milk and set it aside in wicker strainers, but the other half he poured into bowls that he might drink it for his supper. When he had gotten through with all his work, he lit a fire and then caught sight of us, whereon he said, "Strangers, who are you? Where do you sail from? Are you traders, or do you sail the sea as rovers, with your hands against every man, and every man's hand against you?" We were frightened out of our senses by his loud voice and monstrous form. But I managed to say, "We are Achaeans on our way home from Troy, but by the will of Zeus and stress of weather, we have been driven far out of our course. We are the people of Agamemnon, son of Atreus, who has won infinite renown throughout the whole world by sacking so great a city and killing so many people. We therefore humbly pray to you to show us some hospitality, and otherwise make us such presents as visitors may reasonably expect. May your excellency fear the wrath of heaven, for we are your suppliants, and Zeus takes all respectable travelers under his protection, for he is the avenger of all suppliants and foreigners in distress." So how does he answer?
Give us stuff.
Yeah, we're important people. Give us stuff. We want presents.
Right.
Ooh, keep that in mind. We're going to be talking about his character soon. To this, he replied and gave me but a pitiless answer. "Stranger, you are a fool, or else you know nothing of my country. Talk to me indeed about fearing the gods or shunning their anger. We Cyclops don't care about Zeus or any other of your blessed gods, for we are ever so much stronger than they are. I shall not spare either yourself or your companions out of any regard for Zeus, unless I am in the humor for doing so. Now tell me where you made your ship fast when you came on shore. Was it round the point, or is she lying straight off the land?" How does the Cyclops reply to give me presents?
No.
Yeah, no. "And don't threaten me with your gods. I ain't afraid of your gods. I'm more powerful and stronger than they are." So the Cyclops tells him a big fat no. And then he responds by saying, "Hey, by the way, where's your ship?" So Odysseus says, "He said this to draw me out, but I was too cunning to be caught in that way. So I answered with a lie. Poseidon, I said, sent my ship onto the rocks at the far end of your country and wrecked it. We were driven onto them from the open sea, but I and those who were with me escaped the jaws of death." What does Odysseus do here?
Lies.
He lies. It's probably a good choice, right? He's going to protect. He only took 12 men with him. There's a bunch left on the ship, so he lies to protect them. The cruel, wretched Cyclops vouchsafed me not one word of answer, but with a sudden clutch, he gripped up two of my men at once and dashed them down upon the ground as though they had been puppies. Their brains were shed upon the ground, and the earth was wet with their blood. Then he tore them limb from limb and supped upon them. He gobbled them up like a lion in the wilderness, flesh, bones, marrow, and entrails, without leaving anything uneaten. As for us, we wept and lifted up our hands to heaven on seeing such a horrid sight. For we did not know what else to do. Wait, what did the Cyclops just do? Okay, so are we keeping count? Odysseus plus 12 men minus 2. So we're down to Odysseus plus 10. He ate 2 of the men. Did he do it in a nice, neat little knife and fork way? No. It's really gross, right? Smash them upon the ground, rip them up, and just devour them. As for us, we wept and lifted up our hands to heaven on seeing such a horrid sight, for we did not know what else to do. But when the Cyclops had filled his huge paunch and had washed down his meal of human flesh with a drink of milk, he stretched himself full length upon the ground among his sheep and went to sleep. I was at first inclined to seize my sword, draw it, and drive it into his vitals. But I reflected that if I did so, we should all certainly be lost. Why? Why can't he just kill him? The big stone, very good. For we should never be able to shift the stone which the monster had put in front of the door. So we stayed sobbing and sighing where we were till morning came. There's only one way in and one way out of this cave, and it's that entrance that's being blocked by the stone. The stone so huge that 22 wagons could not move it. So Odysseus and his now 10 men don't stand a chance of moving that stone. When the child of morning, rosy-fingered Dawn, appeared, he again lit his fire, milked his goats and ewes, all quite rightly, and then let each have her own young one. As soon as he had gotten through with all his work, he clutched up 2 more of my men and began eating them for his morning's meal. Presently, with the utmost ease, he rolled the stone away from the door and drove out his sheep. But he at once put it back again, as easily as though he were merely clapping the lid onto a quiver full of arrows. As soon as he had done so, he shouted and cried, "Shoo, shoo," after his sheep, to drive them onto the mountain. So I was left to scheme some way of taking my revenge and covering myself with glory. So what's he going to do now? He's making a plan, but anything special about the plan? Covering myself with glory? He's got to show off. He's got to make himself look good. Okay, so keep thinking about character traits here. In the end, I deemed it would be the best plan to do as follows. The Cyclops had a great wooden club, which was lying near one of the sheep pens. It was of green olive wood, and he had cut it, intending to use it for a staff as soon as it would be dry. It was so huge that we could only compare it to the mast of a 20-oared merchant vessel ship of large burden, able to venture out into the open sea. I went up to this club and cut off about 6 feet of it. I then gave this 6-foot-long piece to my men and told them to fine it evenly off at one end, which they proceeded to do. And lastly, I brought it to a point myself, charring the end in the fire to make it harder. This is the top of page 97. When I had done this, I hid it under dung, which was lying about all over the cave, and told the men to cast lots which of them should venture, along with myself, to lift it and bore it into the monster's eye while he was asleep. All right, let's recap. So he cuts off a 6-foot-long, basically a spear, right? So he's got this 6-foot-long spear. They sharpen the end so that it's a point. They burn it in the fire so that it's an even harder point. And then where do they hide it? Yeah, dung is poop. So they hide it in some poop. Then Odysseus says he's going to pick which men are going to help him. And do you know what casting lots means? It's like drawing straws, basically. Okay? And if you draw the short straw, you get to, or the, whichever is the winner. You either get to help or you don't have to help. The men probably all want to help, though. The lot fell upon the very 4 whom I should have chosen, and I myself made 5. In the evening, the wretched Cyclops came back from shepherding and drove his flocks into the cave, this time driving them all inside, not leaving any in the yards. I suppose some fancy must have taken him, or a god must have prompted him to do so. As soon as he had put the stone back to its place against the door, he sat down, milked his ewes and his goats all quite rightly, and then let each have her own young one. When he had gotten through with all his work, he gripped up 2 more of my men and made his supper off them. So what's our body count? How many have been 6 eaten? 6. So it's left with Odysseus and how many?
4. 6.
Yeah. So he's lost half of his men already. Well, half of the ones he brought with. So I went up to him with an ivy wood bowl full of black wine in my hands. What's special about this wine again?
Oh,
unblended, potent, super strong, right? Yeah. Look here, Cyclops, I said. You have been eating a great deal of man's flesh. So take this and drink some wine, that you may see what kind of liquor we had on board my ship. I was bringing it to you as a drink offering in the hope that you would take compassion upon me and further me on my way home, whereas all you do is go on ramping and raving most intolerably. You ought to be ashamed of yourself. How can you expect people to come see you anymore if you treat them this way? He then took the cup from me and drank. He was so delighted with the taste of the wine that he begged me for another bowlful. Be so kind, he said, as to give me some more, and tell me your name at once. I want to make you a present that you will be glad to have. We have wine even in my country, for our soil grows grapes and the sun ripens them, but this drinks like nectar and ambrosia all in one. I then gave him some more wine. 3 times did I fill the bowl for him, and 3 times did he drain it without thought or heed. Then, when I saw that the wine had gotten to his head, I said to him as plausibly as I could, Cyclops, you ask my name, and I will tell it to you. Give me, therefore, the present you promised me. My name is No Man. This is what my father and mother and my friends have always called me. No Man sounds a little strange to our ears. What if I tell you it's Nobody? So he tells him, my name is Nobody. Any light bulbs starting to go off? But the cruel wretch said, here's the present. Then I will eat all Nobody's comrades before I eat Nobody himself. I will keep Nobody for the last. This is the present I will make him. The present's a trick, right? It's not really a present. It's, I'm still going to eat all of you, but you can be last. Ha ha. As he spoke, he reeled and fell sprawling face upwards on the ground. What happened?
He passed out.
He passed out. He's drunk. His great neck hung heavily backwards, and a deep sleep took hold upon him. Presently, he turned sick and threw up both wine and gobbets of human flesh on which he had been gorging, for he was very drunk. Then I thrust the beam of wood far into the embers to heat it, and encouraged my men, lest any of them should turn faint-hearted. When the wood, green though it was right about to blaze, I drew it out of the fire, glowing with heat, and my men gathered round me, for heaven had filled their hearts with courage. Top of page 98. We drove the sharp end of the beam into the monster's eye, and bearing upon it with all my weight, I kept turning it round and round, as though I were boring a hole in a ship's plank with an auger, which 2 men with a wheel and strap can keep on turning as long as they choose. Even thus did we bore the red-hot beam into his eye, till the boiling blood bubbled all over it as we worked it round and round, so that the steam from the burning eyeball scalded his eyelids and eyebrows, and the roots of his eyes sputtered in the fire. As a blacksmith plunges an axe or a hatchet into cold water to temper it, for it is this that gives strength to the iron, and it makes a great hiss as he does so, even thus did the Cyclops' eye hiss round the beam of olive wood, and his hideous yells made the cave ring again. We ran away in a fright, but he plucked the beam all besmirched with gore from his eye and hurled it away from him in a frenzy of rage and pain, shouting as he did so to the other Cyclops who lived on the bleak headlands near him. So they gathered from all quarters round his cave when they heard him crying and asked what was the matter with him. All right, pause for a second. Do you get this image of what they did? Yeah. They have this 6-foot-long spear. At the very last minute, they put it back in the fire so it's super hot, and they stab it into his eye. Do you guys remember if you made that field trip to Old World, Wisconsin, and you see like the old-time blacksmith shop, and they put their tools in the fire, and then they take it out of the fire and put it in the water? What happens to it? Oh, come on, you can do better than that. Take it out of the fire and put it in the water, and it goes much better. That's what it does in his eye. Ew, right? This hiss and steam. And he plucks the spear out all by himself, and it's got all this eye gooey, gunky junk on it, and he starts screaming.
And he only has one eye.
Exactly. He only has one eye, and now that eye is pretty much ruined. There are other Cyclops living on the island. His screams have alerted the other Cyclops. They all gather round the entrance to his cave and say, what ails you, Polyphemus? Aha, finally, we have the Cyclops' name. This is on the front page of your study guide. Take a moment to write that down.